You are listening to Red Ice Creations Radio, and we are coming to you from Sweden in Scandinavia, worldwide across the web. My name is Henrik, and it's very nice to have you with us here today. The website is redicecreations.com, R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com, and that's the place to go if you want to follow along in the kind of topics that we consider to be the most interesting and important. We do radio on Thursdays and Sundays, and you can watch us live from our studio, our live webcasts. That's live video and audio interviews with excerpts, clips, videos, photos, and much more. We have archived shows up on the site and broadcast times you can find also on our website, of course. We also have a members area with video interviews, short films, extended radio interviews, and our entire radio archive. Also, of course, take a look at architectsofcontrol.com. That's a new DVD film that's out now. And this is the collaboration between Michael Tesserion, Red Ice Creations, and Blue Fire Film. And we're really proud of the film, our first full-length DVD film. And I won't sit here and tell you all about what the film is about. You can simply go to Architects of Control, watch the teasers, and read more about it there. But do check it out. Okay, today we have a new voice with us on the program, and this is going to be a really interesting show, I think. If you remember the program that we did a while back with James Furia on music, scales, and colors, well, we're going to kind of do a follow-up show to that one and expand it into some other interesting areas as well that actually connects with synchromysticism. We have Ezra Sanders Bell with us, and he is behind the blog Hidden Origins of Western Music. And you can take a look for yourself by simply going to quantumlodge.org/Ezra. And that's again, that's quantumlodge.org/Ezra. That's E-Z-R-A. So it's very nice to have you with us here today, Ezra. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, Henrik.
This is really interesting. You know, I'm really looking forward to talking more with you about this topic here today. Tell us a little bit about yourself, some of your background, and also, I guess, when you kind of first set up your blog and when, I guess, your eyes kind of opened to this particular area. I guess you've been familiar with synchromysticism before this, but then at some point, I guess you connected that with the music as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. To go back a little bit, I've been studying music formally for about 10 years. I started with the cello, and I kind of played around with it a little bit, but mostly I just played in like symphony orchestras and that kind of stuff. So I did that for about 5 years, and I didn't really do any music composition during that time. I just studied. I kind of got a feel for the instrument, but eventually I felt this need to express myself through the music. And there's the cello is obviously a beautiful instrument, but it's kind of limited in the ability to express yourself in the kind of music that I was listening to, which was, rock music. And so I switched over to the bass guitar, and that kind of started off my exploration into just writing music for myself. And, a lot of people do this where we sit down and we kind of have these musical idols that, inspire us. And so I had, various bands that were inspiring me. And so I tried to write music like that. And that's kind of the beginning, I feel like. You get to establishing this musical taste, and you start creating music that is in line with that. And so that's what I did for about 5 years. I played bass guitar in a band called Piglet, and that was a three-part instrumental rock trio. And we put out a CD and did some touring, and I kind of got that angle too. So, I started off with the more formal classical stuff, and then moved into the touring rock band kind of situation. And eventually I also picked up the acoustic guitar. And so that really opened up a lot for me, because obviously with the cello and with the bass guitar, in either scenario, you're really dealing with like single notes, because the frequencies are so low. If you try to create chords, it's not very easy unless you do like tapping. You got your left hand down here and the right hand all the way at the high registers. And that's like kind of a complex technique. So, the guitar just opens up so much for us as songwriters, because, we're able to sing over it, and we can create chords, or we can do single line melodies. And so I went down that route. And so this is like this, gradual musical progression. And eventually the band started to fizzle away, and I was not going to college because I was pursuing the music route right? So like I'm doing all this music composition. I'm working at a Subway sandwich shop for like $6.50 an hour, minimum wage.
Right.
And I was, to be honest with you, Henrik, I was basically miserable. I mean, the band was fizzling away, and I was trying to write music, but I just didn't really feel inspired.
Right.
Like I'd listened to all this music growing up, and there was so much I felt that had already been done. And I think this is like a classic situation for people writing music, is like, how do I create something that's new and that's fresh, but that also is expressive? You know, it's like, if you think about it too much, then it's just not going to happen. So for me, it was like, I just got kind of like in that rut, you know, and when you get there, you got to dig yourself back out or find some alternative way of approaching music.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I'm really a music lover. Like that's my passion. You know, I've always been into it. And to dig myself out of this rut of like, what kind of music should I write? And I was just kind of stuck in like the pop song structures. What I did is I started putting down the guitar, mm-hmm. putting down all the musical instruments and just saying, well, what is the musical system itself that I'm working within? Like I'm confined. You know, I realized like, why do I feel like I'm trapped in this musical situation? And the reason I think, especially now after having done some of this research, the reason I think is because it is a very limiting system. And so coming forth now into the sort of modern day, I started doing research into the origins, the hidden origins of Western music, because I had taken 2 years of music theory in university. And that taught me a lot about voice leading and like various, musical devices for creating supposedly, you know, what they call consonant music, or music that sounds good to the ear for most people.
Right.
So, you know, they teach you how to do that, but they don't tell you like, hey, you know, you're using a musical system that's been around for, you know, thousands of years, and that has all sorts of like fascinating history, but they don't really tell you about any of that, you know, so you kind of have to dig that up for yourself. And that's what I'm doing at the blog.
Wow, really interesting. You know, I definitely can identify with the idea that you can feel trapped almost in the notes that are given to us, right? I mean, we're talking about 12 notes here basically, and the how many combinations between them can you make before this become, you know, you become tired of it, you know, in a way.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So I mean, in Western music we have limited it down to 12. I don't know if we should begin to expand already going into some of the Arabic, you know, note patterns and some of the semitones that they have, but do you think that 12 tones is kind of a limiting system in that regard, or can you just
I'm sorry to cut you off, but yeah, it is very limiting, but it's actually, I think in some ways it's fascinating that they chose to limit it in that way, because there's unlimited situations that can arise out of these limits. You know, it's like and I think this connects really to all the research that we do. You know, music is kind of usually a pretty good analogy I found, where you put a limit on your obviously. To explain, we've got an octave. When you talk about 12 notes, you're talking about 12 notes in a subdivided octave. So like if I go, ooh, you know, whatever, like this slide, this gradation scale, you know,
yeah.
You can go all the way up and down. And that's, you know, that's has no notches. It has no nodes. So we put these little like stoppers in, and they're all equal distance from one another. And that's what you're talking about, the 12 notes, you know. So we put those stoppers in, and that kind of puts limitations on us. But it also opens up all sorts of really interesting mathematical potentialities, you know, because whenever you have, whenever you subdivide a gradient, what you're really doing is like working with geometry and math.
Yes.
Right, because you've got like ratios that come out of that. And so it is limiting on one hand, because like by definition, you're limiting an infinite spectrum to just 12 things. But at the same time, it's not just 12 notes, actually. It's 12 notes in the octave. But if, you know, every time you climb up to a higher octave, you know, then you're hearing a different pitch. So it is, you know, it's both.
you're saying that we're getting a different frequency if you go higher up in the octave or lower, right?
Exactly. So, like, I brought my guitar here. I'll kind of illustrate it. I think most people will know what we're talking about, but just to be clear.
Yes.
So if you start off, like, on a C note right here, and then you have the octave is this. See, so you can hear how those sound similar, but they're different, right? In the sense that one is an octave higher than the next. So when we talk about 12 notes, what we're saying is that there are 12 steps before we hit that octave again. So that would sound like this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
And then we're back.
1. And then we're back. So 12, yes. And then back to 1. So it's like, it's really interesting. It's like, okay, let's put these notes in different combinations with each other. And so that's like where harmony comes out, where you have, you take the first note, the third note, the fifth note, and the octave, and you get this nice chord. Like, and so that's not limiting. That's beautiful. Like, I'll just sit and play that chord over and over again. And you know, so in other words, you know, we create limits in our thinking. The same reason we use language, I think. You know, we use words which are inherently limiting, but it's also the way that we're able to communicate.
Right. The modulation, that's what makes the word, that's what put the words together, so to speak, definitely. If we talk about the 12, obviously we can draw this back to a more esoteric or occult route, I believe. We can talk about the 12 houses of the zodiac, or even the, you know, the religious symbolism of the 12 apostles, or we have 12 hours on the clock and so forth. Do you think that all these things are connected?
That's so right on, Henrik. I mean, that's like really what started me off on this whole path is like, you know, I saw those numbers. I also saw the number 7, because when we're talking about music, we've got the 7 coming out of the 12, right? There are 7 notes in a major or a minor scale. You were talking about the Arabic modes earlier. They kind of have like different numbers. But in Western music, generally we're dealing with major and minor modes, and then there's like variations among that, but those are the two main ones, and each one of them are these scales. So like if we're talking about, for example, C major scale, you have 1 2 3 4 5 6 7 1, right? So
yes,
you're going 1 2 3 4 5 6 7, and then you return to the octave. But remember, the octave is 12, so it's 7 coming out of 12. And I was listening to a Manly P. Hall radio lecture. He has these free astrotheology lectures that you can find if you do a search for him online. And he talks all about the mystery of the 7 coming out of the 12. And I was like, wait a minute, that's music.
Yes.
You know? So it's like, hold on here. There's definitely some astrological component to music, and nobody's talking about it. And I just got kind of frustrated. Like, hey, you know, I searched and I found like little bits and pieces here. But I think the lesson that I've kind of learned just by starting this blog is, if it's not out there, then make it.
Absolutely.
Make it for yourself.
Yes.
DIY musicology.
Exactly. Definitely. You're totally right. Just do it yourself. That's the main thing. And I mean, I've been personally kind of just looking into the, I mean, very brief area of just connecting the G in the square and the compass of the Freemasonic symbol, of course, with the G in the scale, basically connecting this with a fifth note, that there's a connection here in some way to the music with Freemasonry. I don't know if we need to go there just yet. I guess that there is connection there, obviously, in regards to Western music, obviously. But I want to ask you before we go into the more esoteric areas. When did you set up your blog? Has it been up for a long time?
Yeah, it's only been up for a couple months, and before that I had some other stuff. I came across Red Ice Creations and the Synchro Mystic videos that Jay Kotze and Steve Wilner are behind. I came across those about 2 years ago, and so, you know, I think I was, I was telling you, I was kind of in this, like, miserable state at one point with music, where it was like I wasn't able to go anywhere with it. And actually, funny enough, I came across two things that really lifted me out of that. One was the internet, just doing research, and Red Ice Creations was huge for me in that regard, because it just, it's this, like, very centralized source of incredibly important information that if you're just, like, typing in Google, you're probably just not going to find, you know. So these kind of, not just Red Ice, but, you know, all these various alternative media sources,
yes,
and especially synchro mysticism, got me thinking in a nonlinear pattern, which was so important to get out of this, like, out of this rut of sort of like musical staleness. And so I started creating a blog to chart my own synchro mystic observations. And that took me actually into numerology. I started kind of noticing numbers were the first patterns that I started to notice. And I've since kind of come to understand where numerology comes from. I just recently did a blog post on that. But, you know, numerology is really interesting. It helps a lot with kind of taking a seemingly endless spectrum, right? And you just reduce it to what's called modular arithmetic,
mm-hmm,
which means like it's a clock face, right? Like if you look at the clock, time seems to go on endlessly. Like, you know, we don't know where the beginning of time is or where the end of it is. So it seems like this unending linear thing until you just say time is circular. And so that's what we've done with a standard clock face where there's 12 points. Really, you know, we think we're moving straight on, but actually we're moving in this circle from 12 to 1 to 2 to, you know, all the way to 11 and back to 12. Mm-hmm. And that numerology is based on that. Instead of 12, though, it's based on 9. And so, sorry, I'm getting a bit off topic.
It's really interesting. Go ahead.
So that that kind of mode of thought of moving out of linear thought and into circular thought, and recognizing that you're working within these kind of modalities, like knowing the system that you're working within,
yes.
You know, and being highly aware of that, because, you know, with synchromysticism, I found at times I become very skeptical of this this form of thought, because it seems like there's potential to just kind of go crazy with it, like to just find connections with everything. And so it's like, how do you create a safeguard? You know, we're like that tarot card, the Fool, where you see this guy like about to leap off the cliff.
Yes.
It's like you're looking into this potential to just see connections everywhere. And that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, exactly. You're talking about the abyss of the infinity of the mind, if you will, and just the potential of inspiration and influence. And I think that, I mean, many artists, for instance, I mean, they have gone a little bit mad. I mean, there is a certain level of madness connected with genius, if you will. And I think that it's about finding the balance of allowing yourself to go deep enough into that abyss in order to drag out something interesting. But then again, you need to get out of that again, so to speak, in time, and not let yourself go too deep maybe into it. So that's it's important with that balance. But so you think that from your point of view, you think that limiting yourself to this aspect of music and connecting that with synchromysticism, that has been a ruler, so to speak, for you?
Yeah, well, see, we're working, like, we use language, and we, you know, we put on tennis shoes, and we, like, you know, put on clothes, and we clip our nails, and, like, we do all these things, but then, like, we want to somehow, like, say that we don't buy into any system, you know? It's like, no, we're kind of like, we were raised in this culture, and if we want to unplug from it, we have to use the system against it. You know, we kind of have to, like, use whatever tools we've already cultivated in order to cut through.
Yes.
And so yeah, I think the limitations are really beneficial, because, like, they allow us to see through, you know, kind of like a Michael Tsarian. You were talking about I'm really excited to see the Architects of Control, by the way. It's going to be a great video. But Michael Tsarian really turned me on to this idea of, like, using words and their etymology to understand, you know, to further understand the words themselves. So, like, and I think he borrowed some of that from Jordan Maxwell. Or I don't, you know, it's a common, it's like a classic thing of, like, okay, I want to understand this word. You know, I'm going to break it down into the origins of that word, and then study those words, define them, and take it back to the origin.
Yes.
Of first word. And so, you know, you, like, compare various systems against each other. And what happens is it's like the synthesis where, you know, you come to a deeper understanding. And so I hope I'm being clear here. Basically, what I'm trying to articulate is, like, if we have a system that we're trying to break free from, the best way to do it is to just study the system and know it intimately so that you can break free of it.
Yes, I definitely understand what you mean, and I agree with you. I think it's important. So what you're saying here is basically also that the purpose of starting up your blog and looking into these areas is a way to, I guess, start up the dialogue and get more people to become, I guess, aware of the hidden roots of Western music, right?
Absolutely. And music is such a great place to start for a lot of people, because politics can be, like, scary, you know, when you're talking about Illuminati and like secret societies and this super technology where it's like, you know, there's these, like, real threats, right? But, like, if you don't know anything about it and you're doing this same kind of synchromystic analysis, you see all these connections between these, you know, maybe nefarious entities and what's not, you know, like, if you're just looking in that direction, it can become overwhelming. I mean, that's been my experience. And so I found that music has all of the same trappings of, like, all of other Western culture. But the difference is that, like, you can study it kind of without the fear and still learn the same sort of truths.
Interesting. And You know, if we go back a little bit then, and I mean, I guess people who have been very instrumental, pun intended, I guess, in fixing the system that we currently have in regards to music, we can look at, you know, people like Mozart or Bach or Beethoven or people like this. And as far as I know, I mean, we know about the specific opera that Mozart wrote that has connected
Magic.
with Freemasonry, for instance. That was the Magic Flute, was it, right? So do you think that those types of these kinds of people and even connecting with secret societies, that they have been instrumental in helping to shape or form the current paradigm of music, Western music?
Absolutely. It's like it becomes just increasingly obvious every day. Mozart was a Freemason. Beethoven actually, the records say that he wasn't a Freemason. Actually, he from what I've understood, he really was not into secret societies. He thought the whole thing was atrocious. You know, he was kind of like this reclusive slob who was just a musical genius, you know. He didn't really like that. Mozart, on the other hand, was like really into the whole like put on the powdered wig kind of situation. And so, you know, like both of these people, though, I mean, like their music is very structural, especially Mozart. You know, like we said, he's a Freemason, and he took a lot of the Freemasonic philosophy and applied it to music. So, you mentioned the Magic Flute, but there's also plenty of like little pieces that he wrote dedicated specifically to Freemasonry with the word Freemasons included, like the Song for a Little Mason and this kind of stuff. I don't know if that's the title. I can pull it up, but I have a couple entries on Mozart and Freemasonry on my blog. People can check out for specifics.
Interesting.
But yeah, it's huge. And you know, actually, if we want to go down that route a little bit,
yes,
with Western music, we're talking not just about what we hear, but also the way that it's written down. So when like what's really interested me, like one of the many areas of Western music is like this means of notation. And so I just started with like the super basics. I went onto a music dictionary. I just typed in music dictionary and just started going down like all the music theory and looking at the symbols from the synchromistic perspective. And for people that maybe aren't familiar with synchromysticism, I think most of your listeners will be, but like a big theme in that that's kind of woven in there is this idea of the destruction of the World Trade Center buildings and their parallel to the pyramids of Giza.
Right.
And like, so I kind of expanded upon that and noticed that with the piano staff, which is, you know, the treble and the bass clef that, which covers like the full spectrum of the piano's range. The two of them, whenever you flip it 90 degrees, rotated, then there are these two staffs that are standing like pillars, like these two pillars, and each one has five lines on them. And so, you know, I was looking at these two pillars standing there, and I'm thinking, holy shit, this looks just like the two World Trade Centers. You know, this is that sort of like symbolic comparison that starts to come through.
Right.
And so I'm looking at it, and Jay Kotze's constantly talking about this idea of a third pillar. It's that middle pillar. And I realized that in between the treble and the bass clef, there's actually a hidden ledger line, which is middle C. It's the 40th, mm-hmm. 40th key on the piano. And it's actually whenever you're doing musical notation for the piano, if you have to write, you have to draw that ledger line in. It's actually a hidden line. And so it was like, that's really interesting. You know, that's fascinating. It's like we've got a left and a right eye, and then we've got this third eye at the center of our forehead. Nobody can see, but it's like it's there, you know. And so that kind of led me down that route of like, okay, you know, I've got the middle C and then the third eye and, you know, psychic illumination, you know, like this.
Yes.
And what that does when you start making those connections is like you're empowering yourself. You're no longer you know, kind of a slave to what kind of information or truths that other people are telling you. This is fact, and like, you know, memorize this fact and repeat it to us. And if you can do that like enough times, then you get paid more and
right,
like,
right.
or whatever, you know, like now you get to go up to the next degree or whatever. And so I'm just saying, you know, we're destroying these sort of like controlled sources of information and like truth where, you know, there's this supposedly there's this one truth. And like if, you know, you memorize the truths and and then repeat them back and continue to advance through society. But we're not just destroying, the centralized control, but we're also, trying to empower ourselves and rediscover our own potential to know truth without having to read it out of a book.
Yes. So this takes me into the area of music as, I guess, as manipulation then in that regard, because if we look at the origins of Western music, one tends to obviously think about the fact, okay, are we being manipulated here with the tones and the notes and the structure of how the notes are put together? We have this background of the Austrian, Germanian kind of roots, I guess, of Western music. Do you think that that's that music has been used in order to manipulate people or to get them into a certain mindset or mode?
Yes and no. Like, it depends on how you look at it, and it's a big question what you're asking, because the implications are so huge. So I tend to err to the side of caution when it comes to like looking for manipulation,
mm-hmm.
Or signs of that, because you find what you're looking for.
Of course.
So on
yes.
one hand, I definitely see that angle. On the other hand, I also think that we're ultimately in control of our perception of what's going on. And so if we, hear no evil,
right.
You're not going to hear it, right? But there is, there's no doubt. There's all sorts of bizarre manipulation happening through music. And if we can take it on several different levels. There's like the cultural conditioning.
Yes.
But there's like, I think what's really interesting beyond that, because that gets kind of into like a lot of philosophy, like what kind of music should people listen to? For example, in Plato's Republic, there's this whole section where we hear about certain musical modes should not be played because they excite, the wrong kind of drives that we don't want to have in society. But, I think that's actually a really interesting piece. I'll send you a link to that. But
nice.
There's a lot of subjectivity there. It's like some people want to hear like really fast drums and heavy guitar, and like other people want to hear this like new agey, floaty, airy kind of music, and so like that's subjective. But there is this other element, which is like the tones themselves, which we know that tone affects matter. A big area of interest for me is this idea of cymatics. Are you familiar
yes.
with that?
Oh yes, definitely. But tell our listeners briefly, for those who might not be aware of it.
Okay, cymatics is really interesting. It's like they take a metal plate and they pour this sand-like substance on the plate, and then they channel these tones, I shouldn't say channel. They vibrate a single musical note through the metal, and as the metal resonates, it actually generates patterns in the sand that's on top of it. So I'm not really very scientifically minded, and I couldn't really explain how it works, but basically what you see visually, if you just do a search for cymatics, you'll find these videos where these fantastic geometric shapes are just coming out of nothing. I mean, there's just sand with no order, and all of a sudden we flip on, the middle C, and all of a sudden we've got this just beautiful geometric pattern. And so,
yes.
I think that's really a good visual representation that people can just see and like instantly know, okay, sound is affecting my body.
Yes.
Absolutely. There's also.
Yeah, I just want to squeeze in here. And get your take on it. I'm thinking about if we go forward a bit in time, I guess, in that regard, and look at some of the popular music we have now. What I've, been able to pick up on so far is that it seems like popular music these days really much run on a formula. We have these kind of, hit machines, almost, if you will, of songwriters that are, it seems to me, are working out of the same mold when it comes to creating like successful and pop songs that are targeted for the masses, music that is supposed to sell a lot. And to me, it feels like they really know which notes to hit at what position in the timing and the tempo in order to like trigger something deep within the majority of the people. Have you noticed that too?
Yeah, isn't that incredible? It's like somehow they've managed to get this down to a science. And like, that's another area of interest for me. There's kind of like two aspects with that. First of all, you've got the music itself, and then you've got like all the culture that goes with it. So you've got figureheads, you know, like phenomenon that I wrote about recently on the blog was this idea of like back in the late 90s, we had these two boy bands that were really big in the States, probably all over the place. But I don't know if you remember them. They were called the Backstreet Boys and
NSYNC. I do. Yes.
Okay. So like here's like a classic example of what you're talking about. Where you have like just this unbelievably like garbage music that is completely intolerable for anybody that, you know, has like, you know, an interest in studying music or listening to it and trying to derive like any like true meaning or value out of music. You know, this stuff is just garbage. But, you know, there was this rivalry, I remember, between all the little like teeny bopper girls, the young girls that were like, you know, one half loved loved the Backstreet Boys, and the other half loved NSYNC. And I just recently found out actually that they were both of those boy bands were started by the same guy.
Well, so freeze right there, because I do want to comment. I'm so glad you touched upon this, because what I see developing here is actually the political philosophy of the Hegelian dialectic. Because I think, again, why do we have these two sides always fighting? You know, we have McDonald's, Burger King, we have Coke, we have Pepsi. You know what I mean? It's like they always seem to create these opposite sides, because in that battle between that sides, that seems to get people actually more engaged in the topic. Like, let's say they never were interested in it, but now when these two factions are warring with each other, people tend to side with one or the other. You know what I mean?
Exactly. No, Henrik, that's exactly right. There's the funniest part about this is that, you know, the guy who started it, his name was Lewis Pearlman, and this guy is a total fraud. I mean, he started all sorts of stuff. He started other boy bands too. He's actually the cousin to Art Garfunkel, which I thought was kind of interesting, from Simon and Garfunkel.
Right.
And so like that's kind of how he got this in the music industry. But just recently, actually like May 21st of 2008, Pearlman was sentenced to 25 years in federal prison for charges of conspiracy and money laundering. So it's like, you know, these guys have their comeuppance, you know, like eventually the people that are manipulating both sides are going to get shut down, you know. And that's, and like, this is a reason that I think using music is a beautiful analogy, because, you know, we don't have to be afraid. Nobody's afraid of Backstreet Boys and NSYNC. You know, it's just this like silly musical cultural phenomenon, but it's a microcosm of the big story here, where it's like everybody is sort of like, oh, what's going to happen with China, you know, East versus West conflicts and this kind of stuff. But yes, these things do resolve themselves, like, and so it's comforting to see that happening in like in every realm, not just in the political music scene, but even in music theory itself. I mean, the whole all the Western principles of music are about creating dissonance and then resolving the dissonance.
Yes.
And so earlier you were talking about the G and the Freemasonic compass and this idea of like the fifth note.
Yeah.
I think that is just like an incredible insight. You obviously have been doing your homework, but I actually realized that I was taking a shower, you know, I'm like singing in the shower, and I realized, holy shit, it just comes out of nowhere, like the G and the compass, you know, I'm singing like the C, and I moved up to the fifth, the G, and I realized that there is this obvious musical relationship. Anybody who knows music theory will understand what I'm talking about when we say that the G is the dominant of C. But I've got my guitar here, I'll play you a little bit here. Okay, if we're playing a C chord, it sounds like this. Okay, and so in Western harmony, there's various principles of, like I said, creating dissonance and resolving it. And the most common way to do that is between two notes. That's called the root of the key, and the dominant. And the dominant chord is also the fifth. It's the fifth note above the root. So it would sound like this. If we have a C chord, then the fifth or the dominant chord is G. And so if you kind of hear the two together, it goes like, oh, well, actually, I just broke a string.
Oh.
It's so cold in my house. Oh, that's funny. Okay, well, I think I can still do this. Let's see here.
No problem. Do you need to retune it, maybe?
Oh, no, that's fine. that's hilarious. classic musical situation there. But okay, so like, let's see here. I'll just fly this up a fret. Okay. Okay, so we've got, let's do like power chord punk style, right? So you got like, so you can hear like how those two kind of cooperate.
The relationship
with each other, right?
Between the notes, yes.
Right. Okay. And so that's the relationship between the C and the G. And so like the reason that I've taken an interest to that is because the C, the key of C is actually the only key out of the 12 notes that has no sharps or flats. It's the natural key.
Mm.
So in a C major scale, you have C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C. And with any other scale of the 12 notes, you would have, like, for example, in G, you have G, A, B, C, D, E, F sharp, G. You see? So, like, there's a sharp or a flat note. And so they're, like, alterations. But all of them are alterations of the natural key. And so the natural key is C. Okay? Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing about having G as the Freemasonic note, you know, there's all this Freemasonic conspiracy about them being like the dominating class or whatever. Well, like G is also the dominating note in the natural key of C. So I don't know,
yes.
That I've kind of followed that too. You know?
Well, that is really interesting because, again, as you said at the beginning of the program here, that there is a relationship also between the notes and geometry, and we know that the, you know, the Freemasons are obviously big into geometry, you know, so there is a relationship there. And what do you think that means, though? Do you think that means that, I mean, again, we can even look at the piano, right? We look at the white and the black chords, the minor and the majors. We can look at the comparisons between the checkerboard, you know?
Yes.
Right, it's right there. Any
yeah.
theories or ideas about
sure.
that?
Yeah, so many. I mean, like, you know, I'm actually, through my blog, I'm moving in books. So, like, what I'm trying to do is, like, just keep things somewhat organized so it's not just, like, an ongoing ramble, but it's kind of, like, packages where people can, you know, obviously everything on my blog is free, but if you go go to the category section and just click on book one, then you can see everything from that. And so, like, I feel like research kind of moves in stages, and that was the first stage on my blog. And all of that has to do with the Freemasonic geometry and its relation to music. I'll give one example. You mentioned the checkered board, so, like, you know, obviously in music, we're dealing with tones, but we're also dealing with tones over time, right?
Mm-hmm.
For example, like, it's not enough to just say, oh, we're playing in the key of G. It's like we're playing notes. And as soon as you start playing a note, then time has to elapse in order to be able to process that note. So, like, for example, if I sing a la, you can identify that note, but you also have to identify how much time has passed while I was singing it. And so out of that is born this element of rhythm. And so the rhythm, I feel like, is directly connected to the checkerboard. And here's why, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In a chessboard, you have an 8x8 box matrix.
Yes.
Okay. And so what that means is you have 64 squares. There's 32 white squares and 32 black squares. The way that rhythm works in music is that you start off with a whole note, and then you keep dividing things in half. So that's how rhythmic notation works, fundamentally.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a whole note, you have a half note, or two half notes, then you have four quarter notes, eight eighth notes, and it goes all the way down to 16, 32, and then 64. And I'm telling you, I've never seen any piece that had anything beyond 64th note, except for like some really experimental avant-garde or like modern music. But all the classical music basically stopped at 64th notes. And so, you know, if we take the Masonic checkerboard to be sort of a way of cluing into a visual clue of how numbers are divided, we have like 64 64th notes on there. And then the black and white alteration could be a symbol of the strong beat and the weak beat.
Ah.
So, like, you know, if you think about it, like, if you zoom out a bit and go back to like the idea of four quarter notes, right? You have da, 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 strong, weak, strong, weak. You know, so it's like this this balance of like strong, weak alterations. And so with 64 squares, 32 black, 32 white, you're really dealing with the smallest subdivision of the whole note in the strong and weak beats.
Right, right. That's really interesting. So there potentially could be a geometrical pattern. There could potentially even be music that is, if we were to lay it out in a different fashion, either according to geometry or a path or what have you, there could actually be symbols described within music, right?
Sure. Or let's say we're just playing a chess game, right? I mean, it's like you begin to see like the music of the chess game, you know, literally.
Yeah.
And like there's various other ways. If we're playing a chess game, you know, obviously we move our pieces in various directions. And if you begin to see, oh, you know, the knight, for example, moves in like a certain pattern, and the queen has this potential to move all over the place, you know, in any direction. You know, each one of these are not just like rules of and limitations on the individual player's moves, but they're also, you know, like they have this rhythmic component to them where it's like, it's kind of like if you're walking down the street, you know, there's this rhythm to your strut. Yeah. Well, it's like the chess game works in the same way. It has this certain rhythm. And if you take the chess game as an analogy for the way that the various, you know, higher echelons of society are manipulating the global events, right? You begin to realize, hey, there's this rhythm to the way that they're putting, you know, various pieces on this chessboard and moving through. You know, it's like we can almost like guarantee that there's going to be some sort of attack during this time, or, you know, this, like, we have this feeling that, you know, in 2012 there's going to be this big event, and we know that because we've charted, you know, we've charted various, you know, well, we've looked at astronomy, and we've also looked at the investment that that these societies have in astronomy, and so like there's some question of like maybe something's going to happen there, and so I don't know if I'm getting a bit off topic here, but
no, it's fine. So do you think that potentially there could be, let's say, within important musical pieces you know, really classical musical pieces that the majority still of in the Western world kind of come back to, if you will. Within that, there could be some kind of communication about timelines or even events or other things happening, or like a prophecy, if you will.
Hugely so. Yeah, there's actually, I've got a buddy that I met through the Red Ice Forums named Stephen Gulliford, and he actually just forwarded me a really interesting piece called Masonic Melodies. It's this 222-page book. It's available on Phoenix Masonry or something like that. I think that's the name of the website, .com. And they just added it recently, and it's called Masonic Melodies. And like I pulled it up, and I was looking through it, and near the bottom there's a song called something like the Tribute to Esther.
Right.
And that's kind of interesting. I mean, because like synchronistically we've kind of tied that to Madonna, and you can like then look at, you know, look at Madonna's music and you go like treasure hunting, you know, and it's this like process of, trying to weed out, the real finds versus like the process, which, is like, you know, trying to find connections between, you know, the Masonic melody, which in itself is kind of like difficult to find any meaning in. Mm. So you go looking for the meaning, like, for, you know, a good place to start would be read about Esther and find out about the mythology of this character and read the book, you know, and then look at the melody and see why they would choose, why the Freemasons would choose this melody to signify this story. And, you know, so there's sort of like this musical code that I'm trying to work with. And if you're just appealing to academic sources, you're really not going to find anything.
Really interesting. So and I just wanted to squeeze in there, for those who don't know, the Madonna obviously changed her name recently, or a few years ago, I guess it is now, to Esther. I think it was Esther. And then obviously became hugely involved in Kabbalah and all that stuff. And I think in the mythology, Esther is the... let's see here. Yeah, she's the queen actually of the Persian, or today we'd call it Iranian Empire.
That's right.
And there is something going on there. I haven't studied it that, you know, much myself personally, but just looking from it from outside, I see that there's something definitely going on there. And even the relationship to Britney Spears and her story is, you know, hugely involved in this. I don't know if have you looked into that at all?
Well, it's like there's a guy named Freeman. He does a show called Freeman Perspective, classic show. But he had an episode a long time back that was all about like the various Mickey Mouse Club kids that like grew up to be famous pop stars.
Yeah.
So you've got like Justin Timberlake, who was in NSYNC, and you know, Britney Spears, who's obviously just like going through all sorts of troubles right now, and she's just like, you know, it's kind of sad. It's like there's not really even any music there. It's more just like this this, like, I don't know, like a cultural battle or something. It's like this mythology is being played out in popular culture and nobody even realizes what's going on. They think like, oh, you know, she's, you know, you hear words like, oh, she's a train wreck. You know, we have like these words that we assign to these people and they play out this part, but there's this whole other beautiful, simultaneous, mythological story that's happening, you know, behind the scenes that only people that take the time to actually research it are going to know about.
Yes. I want to get your take on the idea, or rather the question, if you think that this is being overseen from forces by above, or do you think that this is simply plays out in this fashion of its own accord, of because of, you know, the spirit working through our popular culture? You know, what's your take on it?
Okay. I'll try to give an analogy to answer that question.
Right.
Like, I was thinking about this the other day. Like, I went out to St. Louis and I was sitting in, I went to see Mahler's Ninth, and like, I visited this Rosicrucian Lodge. They were having an open exhibition. So that's why I went out there. But I was sitting and watching this symphony, Mahler's Ninth, in this beautiful orchestral hall. And it was just like a fantastic performance, you know. And I'm looking around me and it was like all these people were just staring, their eyes were like glazed over. And it was like this, it was like a really touching piece. And at the same time, so many people seemed like almost asleep during it. Right. And so like, I feel like that is kind of sometimes what it's like out here, where it's like the symphony is a directly correlates to our daily life. And so like that was what I was feeling. And so I was looking at the symbolism of the symphonic experience itself. And I saw, that, okay, there's these people playing various instruments on the stage, and there's this conductor who's waving his hands about, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's the hidden element, which is the composer himself. You don't see Mahler there. Mm. And so, okay, like if you take that as – if you kind of meditate on that symbol, you'll see, you know, you've got these various people in the orchestra who each have their own little part. They just have like a little melody they're playing, maybe on the cello or the tuba, right? But then you've got this conductor who, he didn't write the music. I mean, he's just, you know, he's got the magic wand in his hand, you know. he's waving it around, and it really is a magical experience to watch these people move. And then, you know, but he's looking at the score, you know, he knows the score. And then you've got the conductor. And so he wrote the music. He's a human being who wrote the music. But, like, did he write the music? Or, like, did he channel the music from something else? And, like, that question I don't really know.
Yes.
And so it's like it's like he's the conduit, you know. And but, like, I'm not going to say that there – like, I personally know the, you know, the force itself that created that music.
Sure.
That makes sense. But I thought that it was kind of a fun analogy, because I realized, you know, the word score itself is applied to like the full sheet of music. Mm-hmm. And the word score is also the number 20, like 4 score and 7 years ago.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah, right.
So when you take the number 20, right, like you can separate it into 9 plus 11 or 9-11.
Right.
And
right.
So like you've got the guy who's conducting 9-11, you know, the 9-11 is this orchestrated event. and so like who wrote the symphony though, you know, like who wrote that into the grand play? I don't know.
Yes. Well, that's really interesting. And I think it's just interesting of that idea also, that it's a very much of a collaborative effort. And again, many of the people who, rightly as you said, or behind the music, what I think is interesting is that they sit down with a piece of paper and actually write the music. You know, it's like it feels to me that they're not really kind of even engaged in the musical process per se. It's more like they sit down there with a piece of paper and they can obviously, you know, they can hear the music in their heads, obviously, but and then they like turn it into a conductor who brings it together with a group of people who play each instrument. So it's a really interesting collaborative effort, if you will, in order to bring to make this happen, if you know what I mean.
I do, man. But like say you're sitting in the symphony and like you just don't like the music, right? Then like what do? I mean, do you just sit there and glaze your eyes over, or do you walk out? There's this guy named Gigi Allen, who was like this punk rock guy from like the late 70s through the early 90s. And he was just like this unbelievably vile punk rock guy. I mean, he would just defecate all over the stage and like, you know, rape women and like you know, and then he'd eat his own blood. And like, it was just, I mean, totally extreme guy. And so he gets on the Jerry Springer show, right? And like, this is like just a total outrage because like some people are like not into this guy. But there's also a couple fans there. And one piece in particular really stuck out to me. This guy said, hey, if you don't like the music, then just leave. There's always the exit door. And, you know, Gigi like, you know, nods his head to that. And that's how I feel. That's what's going on here is like, you know, when I was sitting in my room, like I was playing by the rules of the people that created the 12-tone system, whoever that is, you know, whoever channeled that.
Yeah.
And I didn't like that. I didn't like that game anymore. So I just stepped out. I put my guitar down. I walked out the door and whenever you leave the Symphony Center and then you step into the cold night, you know, it's like, it's cold outside and you got to walk home. And so that's kind of like, to me, that's the Stargate. You know, the Stargate is like step out of the Symphony Center and walk home. And when you get back home, you walk through another gate and you sit down at your keyboard. But instead of a musical keyboard, it's a computer keyboard. And like now, you know, you start doing research.
That's an interesting analogy. And you know what? I definitely want to continue talking more with you in our member section. Do you have the time for us? Are you up for that?
I sure do, man. Yeah, that sounds great.
Awesome. And, you know, in the last couple of minutes here, tell people again a little bit about your website, some of the, you know, where your plans are, I guess. I also want to ask you if you have kind of, do you plan to put this together in a DVD form or a book format or something like that? Or are you just kind of just going, wading through some of the basic research right now? What's happening there?
Yeah, I'm a young guy. Like I've actually stopped going to college for a little bit just so I could focus on this research. And I really don't think that I'm in any position to charge anybody for any of the research that I do because it first of all, I don't really think it's of much value. Like I think it's a good reference point. I think it's actually, you know, a lot of fun to read and it's a lot of fun to create. And it's a great way to like, you know, study something particularly and then like have this reference point. You can look back at these pictures that I create and put on the blog and they're like, it'll clue you back into all this information you read. So it's useful in that sense, but I don't think like making a book or a DVD is quite ready yet. Like I just don't have that authority or whatever the qualifications are. I mean, I feel like it's more valuable to just be researching. It kind of takes the pressure off. I guess that's the real truth behind it. It's like, if I'm trying to create something for people, then I have to like meet some people's standards. But if I just am doing it for myself, then I'm sharing with my fellow researchers, you know, and I like that angle more.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that will fall into place and come because, you know, eventually anyway, because again, as you say, in reference to authority, there really isn't any authority. You're the authority now on this subject, you know, in that regard, because you're doing the research. And didn't you do a video, put together a few videos though, or did I?
Yeah. I did put up a couple videos. I did actually created a musical ritual.
Yeah.
Where you know, we were talking earlier about the middle C in terms of the treble clef and bass clef. So I just like created this musical ritual. You know, I'm not really I don't know anything about magic, you know. I've read a little bit about the philosophy behind it, but I don't know anything about ritual. So I thought it would just be amusing to like do my own. So I shaved the ritual into my head and kind of like had the offering to the musical Stargate or whatever. You know, it's like this fun thing, and I took some pictures. My roommates did actually; they helped me out with it, and so we've got some videos up on that online with that. And you can the website is. You mentioned it at the beginning, but it is quantumlodge.org/Ezra. And I do want to say one other thing, since we didn't really talk about this. Quantumlodge.org is actually the house that I live in with two other people, and they're doing a radio show as well. It's geared towards nutrition, and this is like really the main thing, aside from my research, that's completely pulled me out of the dumps, was like just getting remineralized. And yes. So... I mean, I can't emphasize that enough. I'd love to talk about that more in the member section.
Okay, interesting. I didn't know that. Let's touch upon that. And then again, there's so much more I want to get into, of course, a little bit about the system of the 440 specific tuning that we had instigated, as it were, a couple of years back. And then we definitely want to get into some of the more, I guess, some synchromystical examples, if you will, that we can elaborate on. But there's much more to talk about. But again, Ezra, the website is quantumlodge.org/ Ezra. Head over there and do check it out. It's a really fascinating topic. So thank you very much for this segment. Stay with us and we'll be right back. We'll continue talking more with Ezra Sanders-Bell in our member section after this upcoming break. We'll get into DNA, music, the 440 tuning, the connection to geometry, the Great Pyramid, and the Nazi origins of the attempts to homogenize the tuning. We'll also discuss more on synchromusicology, frequency, Quirrell Castle levitation, and music as manipulation. We'll discuss a few bands, a few examples, and that we should be aware of the music we listen to. And towards the end, we'll discuss more on nutrition, kind of following this idea that we need to be aware of what we put in or input into our bodies. And Ezra has some interesting ideas and tips to share with us about that. So much more coming up for Red Eyes members. Go to our website, click on subscribe to get instant access to our entire archive of radio programs, video interviews, webcasts, and much more. And don't miss our live show with Christopher Knowles, Saturday the 6th, on Obama symbolism, X-Files, and much more. All the times will be available on our website, redeyescreations.com. Tell your friends, spread the word. Here's a tune from Ezra's band, Ormus Gold, to wrap up part one.
Like I said, those who see in red, it's doing us wrong.